Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out this morning. This so early. I'm pretty sure you'll enjoy hearing about a man who is very little known in Sabre, but was one of the most influential men in baseball in the 1950s and 60s. 1953 was a pivotal year in Major League Baseball history. The years from 1903 to 1952 had been a period of stability. There had been no changes to the makeup of the American or National Leagues during this time, with the same two leagues having the same 16 teams in only 10 cities. Then in the next 5 years, after 1953, there were massive changes, with five of the teams moving to other cities. Expansions came in 1969 to 24 teams, and then 26 teams in 1977. The major leagues were able to accomplish these changes largely due to one man who worked out of a small office on St. Catherine Street in Montreal. That man was Harry Simmons, my father, who was the major league schedule maker from 1953 to 1982. From 1946, Harry Simmons was secretary of the International Baseball League, which had its league office in Montreal. He was widely known in baseball circles as a baseball historian, as well as an expert on the rules of the game, because he was a member of the Baseball Rules Committee. He was the author of the very popular and influential So You Think You Know Baseball series, which ran weekly in the Saturday Evening Post and later in book form. He served as an expert witness representing baseball at the Congressional Cellar House Judiciary Committee in July 1951, which probed monopoly influences in organized baseball. And he helped to have a favorable outcome for organized baseball in those hearings. One of his many tasks at the International League was preparing the league schedule. And by 1952, he was also preparing the schedules for numerous other minor leagues and assisting the major leagues with their scheduling problems. Now, on March 13th, 1953, just 4 weeks before the start of the 1953 season, Lou Perini, owner of the Boston Braves, announced that he was immediately moving the team to Milwaukee. The Braves had drawn only 281,000 fans in 1952, compared with over 1 million fans for the Red Sox. Milwaukee had just built the new county stadium, which offered parking for 10,000 cars, and was also the first major league ballpark built specifically with lights. Perini had been offered a sweetheart advertising deal by Fred Miller, president of the Miller Beer Company, as well as virtually free rent of the stadium by the city. But the move created a difficult logistics problem for the National League. In those days, all the teams traveled by train, and the new Milwaukee team could not possibly play the schedule which had been established for the Boston Braves. Boston is over 1,000 miles from Milwaukee. Warren Giles, then president of the league, called on the then schedule maker, Clement J. Schwendler, to make changes to the schedule to fit the new reality. Schwendler was a Boston bank official. He had been the major league schedule maker from 1914 to 1952 during this period of stability. Schwendler wrote a long letter to Giles explaining that it would take weeks of work to draft a new schedule, time which the league did not have. Schwenger by then was 78 years old and lacked the energy demanded by this job. Giles then gave Harry Simmons a call, asking him to examine the dilemma. Simmons studied the league schedule and did some mileage calculations on what the optimal change would be without drafting a whole new schedule, and that would cause the least disruption to the other teams. He proposed that the Milwaukee Braves could take on the schedule of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and that the Pirates could use the old Boston Braves schedule. This relatively easy solution both shocked and pleased the league and was quickly adapted with minimal disruption to league operations for 1953. Shortly after this, Harry Simmons was asked to be the future schedule maker for both the American and National Leagues, and he did these schedules every year until 1982. The Milwaukee Braves quickly became the sensation of baseball, setting new National League attendance records of 1.8 million in 1953 and 2.1 million in 1954. Perini was making a fortune, and the owners of the other teams quickly woke up to the riches available in the other cities. 1954 saw the St. Louis Browns moving to Baltimore, and in 1955, the Philadelphia Athletics moved to Kansas City. Then in 58, the Dodgers and Giants left New York for the West Coast. Expansion to 20 teams came in 1962, to 24 teams in 69, and 26 teams in 77. Simmons was continually consulted when these moves were proposed, and he would draft schedules and mileage studies, sometimes suggesting new variations. For example, in 1954, he was asked to draw up a schedule to include new teams in both Montreal and Toronto. He even proposed and developed a schedule for a four-league setup with six teams in each league. Now, he also prepared the schedules for many other minor league baseballs and in other sports as well. Among the minor leagues he prepared the schedules for was the International League, the Pacific Coast League, the Southern Association League, the Mississippi-Ohio Valley League, the Midwest League, the Puerto Rican League, the Texas League, South Atlantic League, Eastern League, the Northern League, the Mexican League, the Arizona Instructional League, the Pioneer League, the Pennsylvania, Ontario, New York League, and the American Association League. So you can see he was a very busy man in those days. He also did work for other sports. In 1968, he prepared the National Soccer League schedule. He did the scheduling for the 1972-73 International Hockey Tournament. And in 1961, he did the scheduling for the National Bowling League, which lasted only 1 year. There's a letter in his collection of letters from Pete Rozelle, then president of the National Football League, asking him to develop the NFL schedule for 1961. Although I'm not sure if anything came from this, I couldn't find any reference to it. I can recall also that he prepared the schedules for the Canadian Football League. And again, I couldn't find any reference to this in his papers. The development of the Major League schedules is a very tedious task, especially in the days before computers. All correspondence was, of course, done by regular mail delivery, telephone calls, telegrams, and in-person meetings. The process would begin soon after the end of a season, when each team would prepare a list of priorities for the next season. including the dates their schedule is not available and dates that they would prefer to be at home. My dad did a lot of scheduling from his favorite chair in the living room of our house in Cartierville, which is a suburb of Montreal. He used these long sheets of paper that he designed specifically for the work. This sheet, got it upside down, was when the National and American League had 8 teams across, and in 24 weekly segments, he would use these sheets to develop the schedule. I used to watch him with his pencil and eraser, moving blocks of series of games in a round. It was like watching a chess master play a very complex game. In fact, my dad was an excellent chess player, and he had played in tournaments in New York in his youth. He told me he once played against Alexander Alcline and Emmanuel Lasker, who were world champions in the 1920s. Now, every team has dates they would like to be at home and when they would like to be on the road. As examples, the Boston Red Sox, of course, demand a home game on Patriots Day, and the Baltimore Orioles want to be away for Preakness weekend. The Chicago Cubs did not have lights until 1988, as you know, so only afternoon games could be scheduled for their home games. The fans of every team want their teams to play at home on Father's Day, but be away on Mother's Day. The schedule is structured in a rotational format so that there's a balance between the series of all clubs. Just some of the many considerations in designing an optimal Major League schedule include the following guidelines. You have to play games in equal series, spread weekend and weekday series evenly among all teams, have geographically sensible road trips, avoid overlapping series in conflict cities such as Chicago, consider special events in individual cities, be flexible to allow for makeup games due to rained-out games. Take special consideration of cold weather teams to try to schedule later date openings. Consider stadium usage conflicts with football teams and rock concerts. And you also have to consider the requirements of the Players Association, which demand one day off every 21 days, and a day off for travel between Eastern and Pacific time zones, and no more than 2 days off in every 7 day period. Trying to satisfy all these requirements and getting the approval of the powerful club owners is an exercise in logistics, politics, and balance, and requires a knowledge how previous scheduling problems were resolved. If anyone's interested in the detailed process and structuring of the schedule, there's a written report describing the process of the 1982 schedule, and I have a copy of it here. Now, my dad told me that the Toronto Blue Jays, prior to the Sky Dome opening in 1989, was actually the most difficult team to schedule because of the early cold weather, unique Canadian holidays, and the fact that the Jays played on the Canadian National Exhibition Grounds with a stadium shared by the Toronto Argonaut Football Club of the Canadian Football League. The Argos had priority because they had signed their lease with the stadium long before the Jays came in on the scene. Furthermore, the Argos would not release their team schedule until June 1st, well into the baseball season. which caused many Jays games to be rescheduled after the schedule was developed. For example, the 1978 schedule saw many conflict dates between the Argos and the Blue Jays. The CNE, where they played, also had scheduled concerts in the stadium, restricting the Jays usage towards the end of the CNE in late August and early in September. Moreover, Billy Graham was scheduled to use the stadium for a week in June. Another serious Toronto problem is that there was 11 p.m. airport curfew enforced in those days, which restricted the home team and the visiting teams from arriving or leaving late at night. So the last game of any series had to be an afternoon game so that the teams could get to the airport before the curfew. There's a letter in his papers from Peter Bavese, who was then president of the Blue Jays, asking that the opening day in Toronto not be scheduled until May 15th in 1978 because of the conditions that they had in April 7th when they opened in 1977. And you can see the snow on the field, which was very common in Toronto in April. It was a real headache for them. But because of all the date restrictions, only one later, because of all the date restrictions later in the season, the Jays had to open against Detroit on April 17th, and they played 13 home games that April, only one of which was postponed because of rain. I can remember attending at least one of those April games in 1978. I treated two of my co-workers to a night game, which was their first major league experience. There we sat, cold and miserable, huddled in seats behind home plate in a constant drizzle and freezing temperatures with the cold wind blowing off Lake Ontario. Blue Jays president Paul Beeston was quoted as saying that Exhibition Stadium wasn't just the worst stadium in baseball, it was the worst stadium in sports. My good friends were good about it, but it probably was the worst conditions that I have ever experienced in a ballgame. I remember starting to wonder who was crazy enough to schedule a game in Toronto so early in the year. Then I remembered it was my own father. The schedule makers frequently blame when a team goes into a slump or when a city faces a period of bad weather. One example that I have occurred in 1978. Now on Tuesday, June 17th, the Yankees played a night game in New York against the Red Sox, which went into extra innings, finally ending after midnight at 12:15 a.m. on Wednesday. Unfortunately, they were then scheduled to fly immediately after the Red Sox game, after midnight, to Milwaukee, where they had a doubleheader on Wednesday against the Brewers. With the players exhausted from this ordeal, it's no wonder that the Yankees lost both games to the Brewers. George Steinbrenner blasted this schedule to the press with headlines in the New York Daily News saying Steinbrenner blames schedule maker for losses. He's quoted in the press as saying, "This year's American League schedule is so destructive that it makes people wonder if grown men could possibly have put it together." In fact, the original 1978 schedule called for an afternoon game in New York, but Steinbrenner had moved it to a night game to attract more fans. And it also did not include this doubleheader in Milwaukee. Simmons' schedule had only one game for the Yankees on June 28th, but the Yankees and the Brewers had agreed to two games on their own to make up for a previous rained out date. By 1981, my dad was 78 years old and starting to develop some health problems. He was still working full-time in the commissioner's office as a general resource to the commissioner and a speechwriter to Bowie Kuhn. The scheduling work was quite demanding and required a lot of travel. He was ready to retire. The Leagues looked around for a new scheduler and decided on a couple, Henry and Holly Stevenson, who prepared both the NBA schedule and the North American Soccer League schedule. My dad was instrumental in helping them understand how the baseball schedule was put together. Armed with this information, the Stevensons prepared a detailed report on the scheduling process. The Stevensons worked on the baseball schedule for 19 years until 2001, when it was started to be done completely by computer in the commissioner's office. Fortunately, my dad was a bit of a hoarder, and he never threw anything out. All his correspondence from his 50-year involvement in baseball, including original research work, letters from the fans of So You Think You Know Baseball, files of papers from his days working in the International League and in the commissioner's office, was stored in many boxes and included his scheduling work, including changes to the leagues, mileage studies, meeting notes, draft schedules, and memos and telegrams. All of these items, along with his large collection of baseball books, journals, magazines, pins, souvenirs, bats, many different league schedules, and newspaper articles, were stored in 70 large storage boxes and 100 large garbage bags. After my dad's passing at 90 in 1998, I donated all of these items to the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, which is in St. Mary's, Ontario. And they did a marvelous job sorting through and organizing everything. This is now called the Harry Simmons Collection in the Harry Simmons Memorial Library. I urge you all to go to the library in St. Mary's and go through the collection. It's a fascinating resource of baseball history with many unknown facts ready to be discovered. I have a list of the holdings in the library, a very extensive list, if anyone wants to see what's in the holdings. John Thorne of Sabre said that knowing of Simmons' reputation as a researcher, there are likely many items of historical significance in the collection. Thank you. You have to turn the mic on.
A fascinating presentation, and the love for your father comes through in it.
Thank you.
How did your father adjust to using a computer?
He didn't.
Okay.
He never used email or anything at all.
That says a lot.
He used pencils and erasers, and he would use these papers to draft the schedule.
First of all, that is a fascinating presentation. Absolutely great. It is. And it should be the poster child for this year's convention in terms of why all the people in this room are Sabre people. Because we could come here and hear a story like that of which we are totally oblivious, but it is important for us to know about guys like your father, because we just walk around and go to games and think, yeah, that's it. So it's fabulous.
Thank you.
My question was going to be, what did he consider the toughest job? But you explained that with Toronto. So that was easy to see, and the Boston Braves thing, he figured that out in 24 hours, so that couldn't have been too hard. Was there anything along the way that he would complain about every year that was just bothersome to him?
Well, he faced a lot of discrimination in his time in baseball. He was Jewish. Our family name was Simonov. He had to change his name to Simmons. And I'm telling you, the Southern owners of the league were very discriminatory to him. And he had to be quiet about being Jewish in baseball. And he was very influential. All the general managers knew him by his first name and would call us at home, and call him in his office, asking him questions. But I can tell you it was difficult for him.
There were a lot of Southern leagues that he did business with all the time.
And yeah. Well, he had to keep quiet about it.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering, I noticed when the Dodgers and Giants moved west, they had these really long road trips, like several weeks. How much did having to switch to air travel complicate the scheduling process?
I think it simplified things, especially, yeah. They always flew to the West Coast after. They couldn't take the train.
Yeah, but the point was that, like, they wanted to save on travel costs, and air travel was
right.
Expensive, so
yes.
That had to figure into the scheduling as well, I would guess.
Oh yeah, he did mileage studies, and he would try to optimize the mileage. It was very complicated to do mileage studies, but you're correct.
I just want to start by saying I think that was an absolutely tremendous presentation, and I'm sure that if your father's looking down at you, he'd be very proud of the job you've just done.
Thank you.
My question is, it being a New Yorker, I was always impressed by how in my lifetime, when it went to Interleague, when the Mets were in, the Yanks were out, the Yanks were in, the Mets were out, and they do their West Coast swings. Opposing Mets would be at home for all the West Coast teams. The Yankees would be in the West Coast that time. How did your father ensure that the Mets and the Yankees were not in New York at the same time and were able to be, you know, on the West Coast, opposing or facing the West Coast?
Well, he didn't just face that with New York. He had that with Chicago, and
yeah.
Of course, Los Angeles had to do that as well. So it was just part of the scheduling process that he couldn't have the Mets and the Yankees at home at the same time.
But he was also able to have them on, you know, flipping their West Coast stands and sweeps.
That's correct. And getting the approval of the league owners for this was not easy. It was a constant difficult work.
The other thing I looked at is that when I look at this myself, and I see that when the Mets would go to play the Padres, Dodgers, and Giants, the Phillies and Pirates would do the same thing. I mean, that was
yes.
An astonishing achievement for me that all three teams would be out there at
yes,
the same time.
It was. It was a difficult process. Yes. Thank you. I can answer questions to the side or the back if you wish.
How did he keep up with the information on all the cities, the stadium conflicts, other leagues, without the benefit of the computer and being up in Canada?
As I said, it's by phone calls and mail, and it was not that easy. Thank you. Sorry.